By the late 90s, I figured it was time to give him a call. I must have been not getting enough rejection in my life. I invited him and his staff to attend the opening of my latest film, the big one. They did. I stood in the back of the theater and watched Ralph having a good time and a hearty laugh. Afterward, I had him stand and take a bow, which was received by loud and enthusiastic applause. On the way out, I gave him a hug. Ralph is not a hugger. Actually, neither am I. I guess I saw it in a movie somewhere, and it looked cool. 2 years later, I'm sitting on the porch in Michigan minding my own business when Ralph calls and asks that I endorse him for President of the United States. I try not to endorse politicians because, well, for the same reason you don't. They're all so slick, they have bad hair, they can't get through two sentences without telling a lie. Ralph was none of these things, just a cranky genius. In other words, not presidential material. In 1996, he put his name on the ballot and then did virtually no campaigning. It was a big letdown to those who supported him. Was he serious this time? Yes, he told me. This time it was the real thing. He was going to raise a good chunk of money, and he was committed to visiting all 50 states. He would have a full-time staff. Lucky them. I wanted to get off the phone and go back to doing nothing. I didn't want to get mixed up in all the hoo-ha I knew would come from such a run. But what was my choice? Pretend the country was in great shape? Put my faith in one of the major party candidates who were being funded by the same big shots I spend my time fighting and filming? Sit in Michigan and feed the squirrels? I couldn't let Ralph down. He had not let me down a long time ago, and he had never let the country down. If his voice wasn't heard during this election, then none of the issues we care deeply about would ever get mentioned, let alone debated. Before saying yes, I decided to send a personal letter to Al Gore, giving him a chance to explain himself and tell me why I should even think of voting for him, considering the Clinton-Gore record. He sent me back a four-page letter, the kind where the first paragraph and the last sentence are personalized, and the rest is spit out at you from a computer. He thanked me for my provocative letter, and then went on to repeat his positions, which I already knew. Although I had kept an open mind, nothing he said convinced me that we were going to see anything different out of him if he made it to the Oval Office. I called Ralph and told him I was on board, as long as I didn't have to wear a gray suit, eat hummus, or gut a whale. Ralph's campaign was distributing a column by Molly Ivins that offered advice to those who would like to vote for Nader but didn't want to put George W. Bush in the White House. If they lived in a state where either Gore or Bush was expected to win by a wide margin, she suggested then they should use their vote to send a message and give it to Ralph Nader. But if they lived in one of the states where the election was close, then they must vote for Gore to block Bush. Me, I normally vote for whoever I think is the best candidate, just like I was taught in seventh grade civics. But what do I know? Privately, I think most of the people in the Nader camp thought what I thought, that once Gore had a chance to wipe the floor with Bush in a debate, the election would be over. So we figured, let's get out millions of votes for Nader to show the next president, Al Gore, that there's a large number of Americans who don't want him pushing the Democratic Party further to the right. A strong vote for Nader might be a way to check Gore and his promise to do things like spend more on the military and less on jobs. Yeah, we were real geniuses. Then came the debates. Ralph was shut out of them, which left America with three 90-minute shows in which Gore and Bush agreed with each other more than they disagreed. In the second debate, the two of them said they agreed with each other on 37 different issues. It was stunning to watch. Gore had blown it. He had failed to unmask Bush's ignorance and stupidity. He had failed to set himself apart and show the nation there was a real difference on the ballot. He had three chances to nuke that smirking son of a Bush, and he couldn't do it. Message to the country, if this is how he caves with Junior, what will happen when he gets in a room with the Russians? Or the Canadians? I was shocked by the implications. It was starting to look as if Gore would lose. He was going to lose his home state. He was going to lose Clinton's home state. He couldn't convince the Democratic Dean of the Senate, Robert Byrd of West Virginia, to endorse him until 5 days before the election, thus sacrificing West Virginia, a traditional Democratic stronghold, to Bush. Any one of these states would have given Gore all the electoral votes he would need to win the White House. Gore was imploding, and Nader voters everywhere were like rats jumping off a sinking ship. Nice rats, though, the lovable, fluffy kind. Ralph saw his poll numbers cut in half. It appeared that he would not get the 5% necessary to receive federal matching funds at the next election. Things at Nader Central went crazy. A decision was made to disavow the Ivins plan and go out on a second tour of states where Gore might win or lose by a percentage point, and Ralph's presence would make all the difference. In some of these states, Nader's poll numbers were as high as 12%. It was a bold, in-your-face strategy that said to the Democrats, "You have deserted your base. You are no longer Democrats. It is now time you were taught a lesson." Nothing like a good switch to the buttocks from Headmaster Nader. "Look, we all know the only thing a politician fears is being removed from that nice, cozy office with the interns and the expense account. That, and the prospect of having to get a real job. If you don't hold that over their heads, they will never behave, never listen to us, never get out of bed in the morning and show up for work." Ralph Nader represented the country's only hope of pushing Gore toward doing the right thing. Everyone knew this effort to barnstorm in the swing states would cost Gore the election and put Bush in the White House. But when you've seen the administration you voted for side more often with the Republicans than the traditional Democrats, when you've watched as these Democrats make life harder for the poor, paving the way for the rich to have their biggest orgy in history, when my hometown ends up losing more GM jobs during the 8 years of Clinton-Gore than during those 12 years of Reagan-Bush, well, here's your choice. Do you want to get fucked by someone who tells you they're going to fuck you, or do you want to get fucked by someone who lies to you and then fucks you? I'm sorry for the language, but that's probably the nicest way to explain how I and millions of other Americans saw this election. You don't have to agree, you don't have to like it. You just have to read that sentence one more time if you want to even come close to comprehending the level of our anger. I know a lot of good people could see no other way but to vote for the Democrat. They would rather be told, "I love you," while getting screwed, than have to look at the face of the beast on top of them for the next 4 years. I know that feeling. Tell me that you love me, and you can do just about anything to me, including trashing me in the New York Times. But these reluctant Democrats for Gore were really our allies. They wanted many of the same things we did. They just took a different path. My attitude was, if Bush won, we were going to have to work with these well-meaning liberals to save the world from the lesser Bush. It was not right to just tell them to go to hell. So I told the Nader staff, "Hey, there's no reason to purposely piss these people, our friends or potential friends, off. Our fight is with those who have stolen the name Democrat, the party hacks, the lobbyists, the weasels who somehow couldn't cut it in the Republican Party because they didn't have what it takes to destroy a national forest or close 1,000 libraries or take free breakfast away from the malnourished little ones in the inner city. You have to have real guts to do stuff like that, and you have to enjoy it. Those who don't get jobs over at the Democratic Party. Our fight wasn't with the core voters who still feel some desperate connection to what is called the Democratic Party. The fact that millions of Americans still hold out hope that the Democrats are going to represent their interests better than the Republicans is more a comment on our failure to show the country just how similar these two parties are and how the Democrats will sell them out nearly every time. The Nader campaign asked me to go with them on this tour of the swing states in the final weeks before the election. I declined. I told them I would rather work hard in those states where Ralph could get a lot of votes without being responsible for Bush winning the election. Why not spend our energies in New York and Texas where the outcome is clearly known? Tell people in those states not to waste their votes on Gore. They will have zero impact. But they could send a strong message if Nader were to pull down 10% of the vote. That was not the strategy that had been decided. They respected my decision and wished me well. I landed in Tallahassee on the afternoon of October 23, 2000. A student from Florida State, his brother and his sister-in-law, picked me up at the airport, and as we walked toward the car, they started asking about the invite they heard I had extended Jeb Bush. "Everyone's talking about it," they told me. "What invite are you talking about?" I asked. The one you made in the paper yesterday. They handed me a copy of Sunday's Tallahassee Democrat, the city's daily paper, and there on the front page of a section was an interview I had done with a reporter the week before on the phone from New York. A big picture of me and a quote challenging the governor to show up and face me on the stage that night. Oh, Mr. Tough Guy, real easy to throw down the gauntlet when you're 1,000 miles away, isn't it? Of course, it's a whole other thing when you're suddenly all alone in a state full of people who don't take kindly to smart-ass Northerners. But I wasn't thinking that far ahead. I arrived at the university and began the press conference. I was nervous. I didn't want any misunderstandings over what I was about to say. I told the media present that Bush had to be stopped. I appealed to the people in Florida that if Gore was their man, then by all means they should get out and vote for him. But if you were voting for Nader, I wanted you to think long and hard about your vote. The stakes, I felt, would be different in Florida. If it's more important to you to stop Bush, then you might have to vote for Gore. I would understand and respect your decision. The reporters were a bit surprised. Was I switching my vote to Gore? No, I said, I'm voting for Ralph. Of course, that's easy for me to say. I live in a state where Gore is already going to win by a landslide. But if you live in Florida, things are different. The story went out across the state that one of Ralph Nader's celebrity backers had given the green light to vote for Gore in Florida, if that's what voters thought was the right thing to do. When the press conference finished, I ran into the bathroom and got sick. It was time for me to go on stage. An overflow crowd of 2,000 people packed the auditorium. The organizer banged on the door. "We need to start," she shouted. "Just give me a few minutes," I replied. I got sicker. Another bang on the door. "Show them a segment from my TV show," I said. "I'll be okay in a minute." I didn't know if I was sick because of this horrible pressure I felt, or because I'd been treated to a Whataburger burger, a Tallahassee favorite on the way into town. Maybe I just knew that the whole election, the whole country, was in the shit can with me, and there was no escape for any of us. 20 minutes late, I walked onto the stage. The Greens were all sitting down front, Nader signs in hand. I told them, and the rest of the audience, that there was a bitter pill I knew some of them wanted to swallow. I told the crowd, "You have to use your best judgment. Follow your conscience. Please know that I will think no less of you if you feel you have to vote for Gore. I will still be voting for Nader," I said, and went over the litany of reasons why it was a matter of conscience for me. I cannot ever vote for someone who believes in the execution of other human beings, who believes that we should continue the weekly bombing of civilians in other countries, who thinks the minimum wage should go up by only $1 an hour, who wants to sign additional trade agreements like NAFTA so that even more Americans can lose their jobs. I told the crowd that I couldn't pull the lever or punch the hole for Gore. A man who wanted to spend more on the military than Bush did, who wouldn't seek guaranteed health care for all our citizens immediately, who thought that Janet Reno was wrong to return little Elian Gonzalez to Cuba. That's who Al Gore was. But I said, "I understand your unique dilemma here in Florida, so don't listen to me. Do what you think is best. We'll sort it all out later. And God bless these Nader kids down front here for their courage and dedication, something that many of their 60s-era parents had long ago snuffed." The Q&A that followed the speech, plus another discussion in the student union afterward with a couple hundred students and community activists, some of whom had driven 3 hours to be there, was a powerful back and forth about how to handle the coming deluge. By the time it was over, it was 1:30 a.m., 5.5 hours after I had resolved my issues with the Whataburger. I left with the sense that a storm was brewing here in Florida, and it might be wise to take cover. I was driven to my hotel, a quaint little place that sat on the pedestrian mall leading up the block to the state capitol building. I turned on the TV and watched a replay of the 11 o'clock news. "A chief Nader backer says Bush must be stopped no matter what," the anchor said. I turned out the lights and went to sleep. I awoke at 6:30 a.m. to catch my plane home. A student was waiting downstairs to drive me to the airport. As I was checking out at the counter, the kid yelled, "Governor Bush just walked by." "Stop him," I shouted, without thinking really. Perhaps it was a reflex, whether I'm in Texas or Florida. When I hear the words "Governor Bush," I instinctively respond with a "stop him." The kid opened the door and called out, "Governor Bush, there's someone who would like to meet you." By that time, I was already out the door. There on this deserted pedestrian mall, which looked like a dark alley in the final minutes before dawn, were Governor Jeb Bush and his bodyguard, walking to work. A black SUV carrying more security was creeping along the car-free street about 40 feet behind the governor. Bush turned to see who was asking for him, and then saw me standing there. He gave that Bush smirk and began walking back toward me. I moved toward him, and the bodyguard went into standby to beat the punk to a pulp mode. "Mr. Moore," Bush said, shaking his head like he'd just been fed the same plate of sloppy joes for the third day in a row. I held out my hand, and Bush took it. "Just wanted to shake your hand and say hi, Governor," I said politely. He squeezed tightly, not wanting to let go until he had said what he had to say. His eyes were like needles that locked right on mine. The bodyguard moved closer. "So, did they pay you enough to come down here?" he snapped at me pointedly. And the translation was clear. "You suck, Moore." My mouth went dry. My heart was beating so hard I was worried he could hear it. "It's never enough, Governor, you know that," I replied with the first words I could muster. Why did he care who paid me or how much? Then it dawned on me. He paid for it. Florida State University. No wonder he was pissed. He'd picked up the tab for my visit to tell thousands of Floridians, especially Nader voters, that beating Bush was the important thing. This was not what the Bush camp wanted Naderites to be thinking. Had he seen the news from the night before? Bush glared at me and withdrew his hand. "Kevin with you?" he asked me suddenly. "Huh? Kevin?" Was this some secret code word to alert the bodyguard that it was time to Linda Blair my neck? Then it hit me. He was asking about his cousin, Kevin Rafferty, the filmmaker who'd helped me out with Roger and me. I hadn't worked with Kevin in 12 years. Why was he asking me this? I didn't know what to say. "Oh, no, he's not here," I mumbled. "Well, give him my best," he said. "Sure," I responded. "Leaving, are you?" he asked. "Yes," I replied, "right now." "Good." He gave me that famous Bush smirk again, nodded his head as if to say good riddance, and then turned and left. As he walked down the deserted alley, I tried to think of some witty comeback, but he was already 20 paces ahead of me. The black SUV rolled down its window. The state trooper inside sized me up, then slowly drove past my feet. The first light of day was making its way over the Capitol dome. I would not see this place again until I saw it on non-stop television 2 weeks later. Every time I've run into one of the Bush kids, it's been a defeating, debilitating experience. For some reason, they always seem to get the upper hand. When I came across George W. in Iowa and tried to ask him a question for my TV show, he shouted at me to go find real work. The entire crowd in the place roared with laughter. I didn't know what to say. He was right. This isn't real work. I had no comeback. The day I ran into Neil Bush, the unindicted co-conspirator in the Silverado savings and loan scandal, I was in the lobby of General Motors in Detroit doing a radio interview. He walked through the door with those four Asian guys, bankers from Taiwan, he later told me. When he spotted me, he freaked out. I was the last person he expected to see at General Motors. "Where's your camera?" he demanded, his eyes darting all over the place. "Oh, I don't have the camera with me today," I said sheepishly and regretfully. A big smile beamed across his face. "Oh, Mikey didn't bring his camera." He reached out and pinched my cheek. "Too bad." He walked away laughing and explaining to the Chinese guys who I was and how he just put one over on me. The only Bush I've been able to reduce to a pulp, I say with shame, is the only girl, their sister, Dorothy. She's sweet. She's a mom. And she had no idea what to say when I asked her which of her brothers she thought would win the Let's See Who Can Kill More Inmates on Death Row race, George or Jeb. She was visibly offended. In truth, she looked genuinely hurt by the implication that her brothers are cold-blooded killers. She looked as if she was going to cry. I felt like a jerk. Way to go, Mike. You finally took a Bush down. Of course, there is one other Bush brother, Marvin, though you wouldn't know it from the media. I've never met Marvin. You have never met Marvin. No one has ever met Marvin. God knows where he is or what he's up to, other than planning how to get one over on me. After the chilling encounter with Jeb, I boarded my plane to L.A., unable to get the episode out of my head. Then, as I was trying to open the bag of honey-roasted peanuts, a bolt of something struck me, and it wasn't the guy's seat 3 inches in front of me. I got on one of those expensive airphones and called Ralph. I spoke to the three people who were running his campaign, aware there was a chance the man himself was also listening in. "Guys," I said, "has it crossed your mind that the most powerful man in America today is Ralph Nader?" Silence on the other end of the phone. "I'm serious. His 5% is going to make the difference. Bush, more than anything else this week, needs Nader to do well in order for him to win. And Gore needs Nader out of the way in order for him to win. If Ralph wasn't in the race, Gore would win. Only one man can call the shots here. Only one candidate has any real say today. And that's Ralph Nader." I continued, "But after November 7th, that power is gone. The power is only good for the week or so, as Gore and Bush see all their plans hanging on the actions of one man, Ralph Nader. Why not use this position of power for some good?" "What did you have in mind?" asked one of them. "Ralph holds Gore's future in his hands. What if he were to call Gore and say, 'Hey, you want to be president? This is what you have to do by noon tomorrow.' And then give Gore a laundry list to pick from. Universal health care, an end to the phony drug war, no tax cuts for the rich, whatever. Ralph asks nothing for himself, no cabinet position, no funding for his projects. He just wants Gore to do the right thing. And if Gore publicly commits to doing so, then Ralph goes on TV and says, 'We've made our point. We have helped Al Gore see the need for X, Y, or Z. He's told the nation he's committed to doing that. So next Tuesday, if you live in one of the swing states and you're supporting me, I want you to vote for Gore. The rest of you in the other 40 states, I still need your vote so that we can build a viable third party to keep Gore's feet to the fire. In other words, declare victory. After all, the reason Ralph's running in the first place, to push the political agenda more our way, will have been accomplished. What do you think?" "We can't count on getting our 5% unless we get every vote we can in every state," the campaign manager responded. "We can't give up a single vote at this point." But the day after you get the 5%," I replied, "that's all you'll have. 5% of the vote and 0% of the power. Today, though, we hold all the power. One candidate needs Nader in, the other needs Nader out. This election is going to be decided by a percentage point or two. Ralph holds anywhere from 2 to 5%. Today, right now, you and Ralph get to say who the next president is going to be. You will never have this kind of power in your hands again, the rest of your lives." A longtime Nader colleague who was on the call understood what I was trying to say. "But you're never going to get Ralph to back down," he said. "It will look like he gave in when things got too hot. Plus, the Democrats have treated him with such disrespect, you'll never convince him that he should help them with anything. Plus," he continued, "what makes you think Gore would keep his promise? These people keep no promises. What about all those thousands of kids on the campuses who have worked so hard?" the campaign manager chimed in. "What about the tens of thousands who came to the rallies you and Ralph spoke at? What about them? Here's their first experience with electoral politics, and the candidate they gave everything for just throws in the towel near the end. You can't do that to them. It would only turn them into cynical adults who won't want to get involved in an election again." That certainly made a lot of sense. The last thing I wanted to do was to add to the cynical hordes who've given up any interest in voting at all. "But," I offered, "isn't there a way we can do this so it is accepted for what it is? A victory for the Greens, for Ralph, for everyone who's worked for him? Because by getting Gore to change his positions, we've succeeded in a way we never thought possible. You know, it's like that ultra-conservative party in Israel that has only, like, 5 seats in the Knesset, but their 5 votes are always needed to form a majority government. Whichever party gives them the most of what they want on their agenda gets their votes. If they join with the liberals to form the government, their ultra-conservative supporters don't get mad at them and accuse them of selling out. Just the opposite. They're hailed as heroes, because although they're only 5 votes, they get their way every time." "Wow, that was profound," I said to myself, teaching political science at 30,000 feet. "Mike," a voice on the phone replied, "are you okay? This is not the Israeli Knesset. You're in the United States. That's not how it works here. Ralph will be crucified if he backs Gore, and Gore will be crucified if he changes his positions at such a late date. It's not going to happen. I told them I understood. I reminded them that Ralph didn't have to drop out, just throw the vote to Gore in a few swing states, that's all. Gore would owe him big time once he was in the White House. We could have our cake and eat it too. No one seemed interested in any cake. I thanked them for listening and hung up from the $140 call. Then I sank down in my seat and ordered my first drink ever on a plane. Somewhere over Texas, I fell asleep. What happened on November 7, 2000 will now always have its own page in the history books. Nader was polling 6% in Florida the day before I arrived. The day after I left, it was down to 4%. And by election day, it had dropped to 1.6% of the vote. But that represented 97,488 Nader votes in Florida. Would at least 538 of these voters change their vote if they had known on November 7th that their specific votes were the ones that would make the difference? Of course they would. I'm curious, though, why those upset at Nader have directed none of their anger toward the other candidates from the left who also appeared on the Florida presidential ballot. David McReynolds of the Socialist Party got 622 votes. James Harris of the Socialist Worker Party, who got 562 votes. Or Monica Moorhead of the Workers' World Party, who got 1,804 votes. Surely there were 538 voters among that group who would have held their nose and voted for Gore had they known Bush and his cronies were going to swipe the election. Personally, that's who I blame, Monica Moorhead. That's the one thing we learned from the 90s. It's always Monica. And forgive me, it's always Moorhead. So blame Monica. Don't blame Ralph. And don't blame me. Or do blame me. Yes, in fact, if the Democrats are insisting on giving that much power to the Naderites, then maybe we should take it. Yes, it was us. We did it. We are the mighty Thor, all-powerful and all-knowing. We will destroy all in our path. Change your ways or we will turn you into ash. It was not we who abandoned the Democratic Party, it was you. You deserted us and all those who once believed Democrats stood for something like fighting for the rights of working people. But you hopped in bed with the Republicans, and we had no choice but to follow our conscience and vote for Ralph Nader. That is the way of Thor. So, yes, we denied you the White House. We tossed your ass out of Washington, and we will do it again. We have over 900 campus green organizations. We have a mailing list of over 200,000 aggressive active volunteers. We won 22 races around the country in the 2000 election, and they joined the 53 other elected Greens who held various offices across the country. Since last November, the Greens have won another 16 seats, making a total of 91 Greens currently holding elective office in America. Five cities in California are now run by Green Party mayors, and most significantly, the number of Americans who voted for Nader in 2000 increased by a whopping 500% over those who voted for him in 1996. This is a growing movement, and it's not just about the Green Party. Heck, I'm not even a member. There are millions of people who have had it with the Democrats and Republicans, and who want a real choice. That's why a professional wrestler won as governor of Minnesota. That's why Vermont's only congressman is an independent, and now so is one of its senators. There will be more independents in the coming years. It can't be helped. Actually, that's not true. It has been helped greatly by the actions in action of the Democratic Republican Party. So, run for your lives. I'm coming out of my bunker. I'm sick of just surviving, of taking crap from the whiners who will never be there on the front lines for the have-nots, risking arrest, taking a billy club to the head, giving a few hours of their time each week to be citizens, the highest honor to hold in a democracy. I want us all to face our fears and stop behaving like our goal in life is to merely survive. Surviving is for wimps and game show contestants stranded in the jungle or on a desert island. You are not stranded. You own the store. The bad guys are just a bunch of silly, stupid white men. And there's a hell of a lot more of us than there are of them. Use your power. You deserve better.
Copyright 2002 New Millennium Audio, a division of New Millennium Entertainment, Incorporated. Produced by Deborah Raffin and Michael Wiener.